Today I'd like to talk about Christmas and New Year's celebrations from a slightly different perspective. You see, we have written a lot about these kind of celebrations. We have booklets out there, we have Q&As out there, weekly updates. I've been talking about it in standing watch programs and sermons, but the retort many times is, oh, that's just you. How do we know that what you are telling us is correct? You're living in a different kind of a world anyhow. I mean, you are old age, middle-aged people. You're living in the 21st century. So today I thought I'd let others speak. I am just going to present you with what others have to say and had said about Christmas and New Year celebrations. Now here's a very famous book, The Two Babylons. You might have heard of it. It was written by, the way he's introduced, Reverend Alexander Hislop, a Christian minister. This book was first published in June of 1916. So, quite a while back, 1916. I'd like to read to you a little bit from what he had to say about Christmas celebrations. Now, he was not a Sabbath keeper at all. There were many things he wrote which we wouldn't agree with. But here's something which is quite interesting because he just relates the facts insofar as Christmas celebrations are concerned. He's asking the question, how comes it that that festival was connected with the 25th of December? There is not a word in the scriptures about the precise day of Christ's birth or the time of the year when he was born. What is recorded there implies that at what time soever his birth took place, it could not have been on the 25th of December. At the time that the angel announced his birth to the shepherds of Bethlehem, they were feeding their flocks by night in the open field. Now, no doubt, the climate of Palestine is not so severe as the climate of this country, he's writing in England. But even there, though the heat of the day be considerable, the cold of the night from December to February was very piercing, and it was not the custom for the shepherds of Judea to watch their flocks in the open fields later than about the end of October. In a footnote, he says, the first rain falls in the month Marchiran, which answers to the latter part of our October and the former part of November, from whence it appears that Christ must be born before the middle of October, since the first rain was not yet come. He goes on to say, it is in the last degree incredible, then, that the birth of Christ could have taken place at the end of December. There is great unanimity among commentators on this point. Besides Barnes, Doddridge, Lightfoot, Joseph Scaliger, and Jennings in his Jewish Antiquities, who are all of the opinion that December 25th could not be the right time of our Lord's Nativity, the celebrated Joseph Mead, M-E-D-E, pronounces a very decisive opinion to that effect. Now, this particular individual wrote in 1672, quite a while back. After a long and careful disquisition on the subject, among other arguments, he adduces the following, and I quote, at the birth of Christ, every woman and child was to go to be taxed at the city whereto they belonged, whither some had long journeys. But the middle of winter was not fitting for such a business, especially for women with child and children to travel in. Therefore, Christ could not be born in the depth of winter. Again, at the time of Christ's birth, the shepherds lay abroad watching with their flocks in the night time, but this was not likely to be in the middle of winter. And if any should think the winter wind was not so extreme in these parts, let him remember the words of Christ in the Gospel, pray you that your flight be not in the winter. If the winter was so bad a time to flee in, it seems no fit time for shepherds to lie in the fields in, and women and children to travel in. Indeed, it is admitted by the most learned and candid writers of all parties that the day of our Lord's birth cannot be determined, and that within the Christian Church no such festival as Christmas was ever heard of till the 3rd century, and that not till the 4th century was far advanced did it gain much observance. How then did the Romish Church fix on December 25 as Christmas Day? Why, thus. Long before the 4th century, and long before the Christian era itself, a festival was celebrated among the heathen at that precise time of the year in honor of the birth of the son of the Babylonian queen of heaven. And it may fairly be presumed that in order to conciliate the heathen and to swell the number of the nominal adherents of Christianity, the same festival was adopted by the Roman Church, giving it only the name of Christ. This tendency on the part of Christians to meet paganism halfway was very early developed. And we find Tertullian, even in his day, about the year 230, bitterly lamenting the inconsistency of the disciples of Christ in this respect, and contrasting it with the strict fidelity of the pagans to their own superstition. By us, says he, gifts are carried to and fro, New Year's Day presents are made. That Christmas was originally a pagan festival is beyond all doubt. Now, you might have heard different. You might have heard people say, oh, well, you know, I don't care. I don't care because it's just fun to do it. Now, this Christian author goes on to say, in Egypt, the son of Isis, the Egyptian title for the Queen of Heaven, was born at this very time, about the time of the winter solstice. Even where the sun was the favorite object of worship, as in Babylon itself and elsewhere, at this festival he was worshipped not merely as the orb of day, but as God incarnate. It was an essential principle of the Babylonian system that the sun, or Baal, was the one only God. When therefore Tammuz, who is mentioned in the Bible, by the way, was worshipped of God or as God incarnate, that implied also that he was an incarnation of the sun. He goes on to say, again, this is not coming from us. That's something which was known already by the early Christians. It was known by this man Mead in the 17th century, and was known by this author in 1916. The candles lighted on Christmas Eve and used so long as the festive season lasts, were equally lighted by the pagans on the eve of the festival of the Babylonian gods to do honor to him. For it was one of the distinguishing peculiarities of his worship to have lighted wax candles on his altars. The Christmas tree, now listen closely, Mr. O'Reilly, from Fox News, who recently gave a program in which he said that the Christmas tree was kind of invented by the Germans in the 17th or whatever century. I was shocked by this ignorance of the man. Listen to this. The Christmas tree, now so common among us, was equally common in pagan Rome and pagan Egypt. In Egypt, that tree was a palm tree. In Rome, it was a fir. The palm tree denoting the pagan Messiah as Baal Tamar. The fir referring to him as Baal Berith, the mother of Adonis, the sun god and great divinity, was mystically said to have been changed into a tree, and when in that state, to have brought forth her divine son. Later on he says, the 25th of December, the day that was observed at Rome as the day when the victorious God reappeared on earth, was held at the Natalis Invicti Solis, or the birthday of the unconquered sun. And then he points out that they had a term which was Baal Bereth, which meant literally Lord of the Fir Tree. So far, the two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. I got another book, which was published by the Reader's Digest Association, entitled Why in the World? So, you think they are crackpots? You think they don't know what they're talking about. You think you just can't ignore what they are writing, even though what they are writing is the facts. Then listen what they have to say. An article titled, Why Do We Celebrate Christmas? The Greek writer Origen, a devout Christian, declared in about the year 200 that it was sinful to celebrate Christ's birthday. Sinful. In the year 200. When Christians in Europe broke away from the Catholic Church during the Reformation, many old customs were suppressed. In England, after the Civil War, Oliver Cromwell. Now, some have not even heard of Oliver Cromwell. It just shows their ignorance in these matters. After the Civil War, Oliver Cromwell and the Puritan outlawed Christmas celebrations as heathen, as pagan. And town criers warned citizens not to celebrate it in any way. It was work as usual. Shops and markets stayed open. Parliament itself set on Christmas Day to set an example to the nation. Now, if our Congress would do that, rather than going home for Christmas and having Christmas celebrations, if they would stay to try to figure out how to deal with a financial cliff, maybe they could come up with a solution. But no, they rather want to go home to celebrate Christmas. Goes on to say, the same situation had prevailed in the New World, the United States of America, as it's called today, since 1621, when a law passed by Governor Bradford of the Plymouth Colony. Now, some don't even know who that man was, because they just don't know history. Listen what that law had to say. Prohibiting Christmas observance. That's here in the United States, in 1621. Because they realized it to be thoroughly pagan. It goes on to say, another law in 1659 pronounced, whosoever shall be found observing any such days as Christmas, either by forbearing of labor, feasting, or any other way, shall pay 5 shillings as a fine to the country. Wow. If we were to establish that law today, we might get rid of our debt. For all those who still want to keep it, being ignorant of the true facts. Goes on to say, when the English monarchy was restored under Charles II in 1660, old customs returned, but for many years the Puritan influence lived on. It was not until the late Victorian period. Now, Queen Victoria reigned from 1837 to 1901. So it was only then that the feasting and merrymaking of earlier times regained their place in the English Christmas. Worldwide, the church in general took a pragmatic stance, unable to ban the pagan excesses that had become part of the celebration. It endeavored to rid them of their undesirable features and welcomed the refurbished rites into Christmas, rejoicing as if they were sacred. The old-time Christmas customs survived. New ones were added. Christmas became, as we know it today, a magical mixture of Christian devotion and pagan pleasures. A festival that survives through popular demand. These are the facts. Here's another article in the same book about New Year's noise. Ask the question, why do we greet the New Year with noise? Have you ever thought about that? Wondered about that? It says, it's a custom that has spread from Europe to many parts of the world. The clock takes away the seconds of the dying year, and suddenly, on the last stroke of midnight, voices shout, bells ring, car horns, factory hooters blast away, all in a concerted bid to make as much noise as possible. You might add fireworks as well. Ring out the old, ring in the new, is the comparatively recent explanation of a superstition that has figured in New Year celebrations since pagan times. For centuries in the Scottish Highlands, villagers carrying sticks and dried cow hides surrounded one another's houses each New Year's Eve. As midnight came, they thrashed the walls with clubs and beat their sticks against the cowhides, chanting and shouting as loudly as they could. It was a riot designed to drive out the fairies, demons, and spirits of the old year. The same ritual, a superstitious clearing of the air to give the new year a fair chance to bring good fortune, has been handed on, though possibly few understand why they are called upon to make such a racket at midnight. Now, several years ago, the German PM magazine, subtitled The World of Knowledge, and I have a sample copy of this right here. It's a respectable magazine. It's not something like the National Enquirer, as you can see. They wrote an article on New Year celebrations. I saved this one. It's right here, on New Year celebrations. They asked the question, what's special about New Year's? And, of course, it's in German, so I translated a few excerpts from it. Now, of course, you might doubt my accurate translation. You're more than welcome to read the article in German if you doubt me. But this is what it says. And again, this has nothing to do with any religious interpretation. It's just giving you the facts. What's special about New Year's? There is no objective reason, they say, why January 1 is a better day for the New Year than any other day. The Macedonians began the New Year in the autumn, and the ancient Greeks in the middle of the summer, at New Moon. January 1, as the beginning of the New Year, goes back to Roman arbitrariness. Consul Fulvius Nubilor was prevented in 153 BC because of a war to begin his rulership on March 15, which had been the day of the New Year up until then. And according to the Hebrew calendar, the New Year, in fact, starts in the spring, not in the cold time of winter. This article goes on to say, therefore, the council transferred the day of the new year to January 1, which was more convenient to him. The date was accepted by Julius Caesar and has endured thanks to the Julian calendar, as it was favorable for new beginnings. After all, the double-faced Roman god Janus was a protector of the month of January. That's where the name January comes from. Pope Gregory VIII, who corrected the Julian calendar for us, maintained January 1 as the New Year's Day. Now listen closely. Between Christmas and January 6, the ghosts became alive. When winter storms howled around the houses of the Germanic tribes, Woden's wild hunt was present, a frightening train of gods, demons, and ghosts of the dead. These ghosts were driven away with big fires and cracks of whips. The ancient placed sacrificial offerings and gifts for the demons in front of their doors. Christianity could not eradicate those pagan customs, quite to the contrary. The cracks of whips changed with the intervention or invention of black powder to fireworks. So here are some of the facts relating to Christmas and New Year's. You gotta make a choice, a decision. All of you who are listening in, who are watching this, would you continue with blatantly pagan rites and customs only because the rest of your neighbors and friends and relatives might be doing it? Or are you intelligent enough to stay away from this foolishness and the ignorance of those people who promote it and say, no, enough is enough? Thanks very much for listening.